Being an addict during the holidays can be a surreal experience, and that's putting it lightly. My first Christmas as a junkie was actually pretty awesome, if you can believe it. I was still a weekend warrior back then, limiting my doses to stave off physical addiction, and whenever I felt myself getting a little too into it, I'd wean myself off with Suboxone and then start all over again. But then, as time went by, the small amount I used to do wasn't enough, so just a little got to be more and more. Slowly but surely, it took over my hobbies, work, then eventually family, until the only important thing in the world was making sure that I had enough not to get dope sick. I managed to stay functioning for about a year, and by that I mean I managed to hold down a job, keep up with relationships, and otherwise refrain from being a total screw-up. But after a bad breakup with the one girl that was holding me together, I gave up on any kind of dream or aspiration I had and settled on taking H for the rest of my life instead. I guess that sounds like a pretty crappy decision when I lay it out like that, but that's essentially what I did. I told myself it was all just temporary, that my so-called hero's journey would end in me kicking H after a few months on my butt, and that it would all end up being a crazy story that I told my drinking buddies one day. Well, a few months turned into 6 years of lost time, and like I said, the first few holiday seasons weren't so bad. But once I stopped talking to my parents and moved up to Portland, that's when things started getting rough. For a start, a junkie in the Pacific Northwest, the year is split into two halves. As the old Ella Fitzgerald song goes, summertime and the living is easy. And that's for all the obvious reasons you can imagine. Nice weather, good dope after the dry season harvest down in Mexico, and everyone's relatively chilled out. But then in winter, all you got is dope from the wet season harvest, which is weak crap that barely gets you high. Then on top of that, when it gets real icy or the snow is too thick, getting your hands on enough dope to see you through the day gets tougher and tougher. Then eventually around Christmas, pretty much everyone who isn't a degenerate junkie takes a 24 to 48 hour break to sing Feliz Navidad, see their families and eat their turkey or whatever. An experienced junkie knows to stock up before then, meaning people are boosting and selling like crazy in anticipation of their dealers turning their cell phones off for the day. So in the run-up to Christmas, I've been squirreling away cash like crazy, and on the 23rd, me and my girl managed to score 15 grams of crappy dope that'd be enough to see us through this next week or so, without having to go out into the ice and snow to score more. We scored in the early afternoon, went back to my apartment, did enough to stop getting sick, then I went off to work for a few hours. My girl had a job working as a waitress and started her shift like an hour or two after I did, so it was normal that I'd come home to an empty apartment. So I finished my shift, one of the guys from work gives me a ride back home, and I got these tingles of exhilaration knowing I'm about to spend an hour or two in a warm bath with a few bumps of H to keep me company. I walk into my apartment, flop down onto the couch, then reach under it to pull out the little wooden box that we'd kept our dope in, and I sat it down on the coffee table, flipped it open, but instead of the five little baggies that should have been staring at me, there was nothing. At the time, I figured there had to be some kind of mistake. I had all these wishful thoughts, like maybe my girl had stashed the dope elsewhere after she saw the cops hanging around our apartment building or something, or maybe she poured all the dope into one of the bigger baggies that we had. You'd honestly be amazed at how much people will pay for baggies when they really, really need them, so maybe she'd sold or swapped the smaller ones, then just forgotten to put the dope back in the box. It sounds really pathetic looking back on it, but it took me a really depressing long amount of time to realize that there wasn't some innocent explanation for 300 bucks worth of dope going missing. My girl wasn't my girl anymore, and on her way out, she'd stolen almost everything of value that she could carry. Again, sounds pretty pathetic, but I think that was one of the single worst moments of my life right there. My immediate reaction was, well, bad, but with addiction comes a certain pragmatism. Every moment I wasted freaking out that the love of my life had betrayed me for a few bags of dope was one that I wasn't spending trying to recoup my losses. So I got to work. I walked for miles, literally miles, making almost constant phone calls to a bunch of different people. Now don't get it twisted, I was still trying to call my girl, but she continued ducking my calls, and in the end, it didn't make sense to jam up my line with calls to her voicemail, even if it did mean that I could leave her some threatening voicemails. I'm not proud of it, but it is what it is. Anyway, I call around every dealer I know, and everyone is either out of stuff or is finishing up for the night and not answering their phones. All out of options, I started calling around everyone I know that uses, and all I can get my hands on is enough dope to last me the night. I walk over to the place, get the stuff, and walk all the way back to my apartment. I'm still trying to get a hookup the whole way. When I get back, I wait until I'm feeling gross, then I fix, go to bed, and wake up bright and early the next day to start all over again. The next day, pretty much the same thing happened, only without the goddamn disaster at the start of it. I walked all over town, almost constantly on the phone, but all I could find was enough to fix me for that night and that night alone. Everywhere I went, I was asking if anyone had seen my girl, and when everyone said no, every single time, I had this overwhelming sensation that they were lying to me. I guess it was partly paranoia, but partly based in fact too, because she couldn't have just disappeared on her own like that. Someone knew where she was, and who she'd run off with. But even if they knew, they'd never tell me. No one wanted to have the blood on their hands, and given the headspace that I was in at the time, I honestly couldn't tell you what I'd have done if I'd gotten my hands on my thieving ex-girlfriend. Anyway, like I said, I did a lot of walking, and only managed to get a hold of about a half a gram, so despite having enough to keep me from going into withdrawals on Christmas Eve, I knew Christmas Day was going to be rough as all hell. But still, the poetry of it wasn't lost on me. Cold turkey on Christmas Day, no better day for it, right? The weird thing, though, is when you're on heroin, or any kind of powerful opiate, it kind of makes you chemically incapable of caring. Ever wonder why street junkies seem to have zero shame when it comes to begging or shoplifting? We just don't care. At least after those first few times, if you're deep enough into it, it becomes just another thing. So, I knew I was screwed, but it wasn't going to hit me until I started to get sick, and when it did, it hit me all at once. Around 8:30 on Christmas morning, I started calling everyone I knew who used again. This was the third day in a row, so people were only naturally starting to get sick of hearing from me. Everyone was either out or didn't have a single hit to spare me, and the more desperate I got, the more I turned to sketchier and sketchier sources. These were people who, for one reason or another, I'd learned not to associate or do business with, and in the case of one of them, I literally had him saved in my contacts as Sketchy Kevin. I worked my way through Sketchy Kevin, another guy I'd call Pissy Pete, and then finally a guy named Rat Tail. Named so because he wore his hair in a rat tail like 10 years ago after it got lame to do so. He also partly earned the nickname due to being a complete and utter scumbag, but by noon on Christmas Day, I was relying on that scumbag to score me some dope. Rat Tail said that he'd see what he could do, and would call me back if anything came up. About an hour later, he did, but it wasn't exactly what I wanted to hear. Rat Tail said that there was a dude named George, who would just straight up give me a couple of grams, but he just needed a favor. Right away I thought that that was weird, because who the hell just gives away dope? But Rat Tail said that he wasn't a junkie, and he needed someone who didn't mind getting their hands dirty. I didn't like the sound of that, nor did I have any idea what Rat Tail meant. But I was also in no position to turn the offer down, so off I went after getting a hold of George's address. The last place I expected to end up that day was a nice-looking three-story right on the edge of where the city meets the suburbs. It was way too nice of a place to have any heroin inside, but then again, appearances can be deceptive. I walked up the driveway, knocked on the door, and some totally normal-looking, well-to-do dentist-looking dude welcomes me inside like I'm some late dinner guest that he'd been expecting. It was to the point where, despite this dude expecting me, I sort of didn't believe that he had the dope to just give away, and I started thinking that he was like a cop or something. I don't know how that had worked out, but I honestly couldn't mentally handle the setup, so I just started asking questions. Where's this dude's family? Did he actually have the dope? Could I see it, and could I fix before I did whatever he wanted me to do? The guy had no problem showing me the dope, and he had no problem if I used a little, if it helped me get the job done. I was so desperate by then that whatever it was didn't matter. All that mattered was the dope. I took the baggie he gave me, went up to the bathroom and did my thing. All I did was smoke and snort. Never got into needles, always hated them, so it was a relatively quick process of snorting some and then seeing what the deal was with the task that he wanted. And during that, George leads me onto the third floor of the house and into what he said was the guest bedroom. And there, lying on the bed, was the body. The kid looked to be about high school age, and he was just laying on their back, wide-eyed, with all this dried puke around his mouth. I'll never forget what George said to me when I gave him this look of horror. He was 18, I swear. The poor kid's age was the very last thing on my mind in that moment. I had a ton of other questions, and George seemed more than happy to fill me in without me asking.
I don't know what happened. One minute we were, you know, then the next he...
And that was all he said. Well, aside from the very last thing, which was,
I need him gone.
I'd rather not go into what happened next. I'm not proud of it, and to be perfectly honest, it's extremely incriminating. I don't imagine George was really George, and I don't know how in the hell he knew a guy like Rat Tail, but the only thing that keeps my conscience clean is thinking that at least he didn't kill him. If it was just a tragic accident that happened, I don't know, somehow, then all I did was help clean it up. At least that's what I told myself at the time. And now I'm not so capable of lying to myself that easily. I don't know if the poor kid was ever found, but if he was, it was never linked back to me. Maybe that George character, but never directly to me. And so, that's the story of the worst Christmas I ever had, where I hid a dead body for some varnished old psycho just to get enough heroin to see me through the holidays. Worst thing is, I didn't even quit for like another year. Not truly, that is. But that was definitely the event that made me realize that I truly hit rock bottom. Getting clean was rough too, especially rough. I wanted so badly to put things right, but not only was I so high at the time that I'm not sure I could remember exactly where I put all the pieces, but I was far too cowardly to face up to all the terrible things I'd done during my years as a junkie. I guess this works as a sort of confession too, but I think it reads much better as a warning, and not even specifically regarding heroin either. No matter what you do in life, don't ever sell your soul for anything. And by that I mean, nothing is worth selling your conscience or your innocence for, because they're not things that you can never get back once they're gone. And my second warning is that ghosts are very, very real. They're not real in the sense that you might expect, but if you do something terrible enough to someone innocent enough, you can bet your bottom dollar they'll haunt you for the rest of your life. Just like that poor naked teenager with puke around his mouth still haunts me every single Christmas.
I'm an elementary school teacher. Winter break just started. I'm feeling super joyful. But before break, some of the kids were talking about their presents and Santa. It got me thinking about when I stopped believing in Santa, which is the story that I'm going to share with you all, because when it comes to finding out about Santa Claus and that he isn't real, I had a pretty uniquely terrifying experience. I loved Christmas. I mean, I still do. But as a child, I absolutely could not sleep on Christmas Eve. I tried to spy Santa a million times. I'd wait for my parents to go to bed, try to sneak out. They'd catch me every single time. Except one year. I was in second grade, so probably like 6 or 7 years old. I recall my best friend at school saying something like, "Pretend to be asleep. Then my parents will go to sleep faster, so sneaking out to meet Santa would be easier." Perfect. So Christmas Eve shows up. I'm riddled with angst, and I remember my friend's advice. Pretend to be asleep. And that's what I did. Before Christmas Story was even over, I started to act sleepy. I don't know how great my acting skills were, but it was good enough to where my dad said he should just take me up to bed. I obliged and allowed myself to be carried. When my dad left the room, I think I waited just a few moments before getting out of bed and sitting next to the door. I was listening for all the key indicators that the house was sleeping. What I remember most is how long it took. Forever. I actually dozed off, and when I woke up, the house noises had subsided. I figured my parents had been in their room for long enough, and decided now I'm gonna make my move. Opening my door with such grace, I slid out of the doorway and started my way up to the living room, a combo of tiptoeing and sliding, until eventually I reached our couch. I dove into the couch, lifted the curtains, and then sat wrapped up in a blanket, peering out the window for Santa. It was snowing, and I could have sworn that I heard sleigh bells, but I wasn't seeing anyone. I had a gut-wrenching thought. Maybe he had already come. I squirmed out of the blanket and curtains, looked at the tree and stockings, and phew, he hadn't arrived yet. As I maneuvered back under the curtains, I'm shocked. I see the man himself, Santa. He's walking though, no sleigh and no reindeer. But I'm not picky, it's Santa. I realize he's gonna pass right by my house, but he's looking all over the place, at all the houses and all the windows. What's he looking for? I think to myself. Then he stops in his tracks, gives another look around at all the houses before his eyes land on me. He sees me. I'm ecstatic. I start waving excitedly, trying so hard not to squeal. He waves back, and then looks around before he starts walking toward my window. As he approaches, I notice that he's got a bag with him, and I assume it's full of presents. He mouths or whispers the phrase, "Do you want to come say hi to Santa, sweetie?" I shake my head yes. He points to the front door. I leave the window and walk over to the door, where there's another long window that reached the floor. I watch as Santa tries to open up the door, but it's locked. I reach for the lock, unlocking the door, and he tries again. From the other side of the door, I hear him say, "Okay, sweetie, you just gotta unlock that other lock, the one on the doorknob." So I try to do what he's telling me, but for some reason, I can't quite grip the lock. My little fingers keep slipping. Santa then tells me, "It's okay, just go to the back door." Brilliant. I scoot over to the back door, and I wait for Santa. He rounds the corner, and the light from the back deck turns on. Santa is fully illuminated. I remember thinking, wow, Santa is a lot younger than I thought he was. Skinnier, too. The lights seem to scare him. He almost ran away until he saw me standing there. Then he proceeded to hustle towards the door. He was telling me and motioning me that I need to be quick. He said he had something special for me, but he had to then go. He leaned down and was reaching for something inside his bag. I unlocked the sliding glass door. I pushed my hands against the glass and start to push the door by walking my body in the direction I needed to open it. I'll note that even today, this door is hard to open or close if it's at the wrong angle. But at 6 or 7, it's nearly impossible. Just as he turned around, I heard the door start to give way, and as soon as it had, the home was filled with this awful sound of alarms. I took my hands away from the door and plugged my ears, and I looked at Santa. He now looked panicked. I noticed he was now holding some sort of rope in one hand, and a bag in the other. He drops the bag and reaches for the sliding door. He slides it open no problem. He then reaches for me, but before I can reach back or move or do anything, I'm swept up by my mother. My dad kicks Santa square in the chest, knocking him back several feet, landing him on his backside. That's all I saw before my mom rushed me back to their bedroom and locked the door. My mom tells me that I didn't even cry at that point, which makes sense. I don't remember crying or even being terribly upset. Not until later. It was when my parents explained that the man who came to our house wasn't Santa. My dad kept saying things like, "She still thinks he's real. Of course she tried to let the guy in." Then I did start crying. That was all while the police were there. What happened to the guy? He got away-ish. The guy took off once he gained footing, and my dad didn't bother chasing him because he'd gotten the guy's wallet. The cops were on the phone and the guy left his bag behind. That bag wasn't filled with presents. My dad told me that it was filled with more rope, like the kind the man had been holding. There was duct tape, candy, miscellaneous tools like a hammer, a lot of plastic bags and random clothes. Yeah, it's horrifying. But luckily, he was picked up just a few minutes after he left our house. Pretty hard not to spot the guy running around town dressed up like Santa Claus. In the end, I did forgive my parents for ruining the magic that is believing in Santa, because you know, they did save my life. Normally, I don't go out Christmas shopping on Black Friday. I know there's deals to be gotten, but the actual amount of people who get them is pretty low. It sometimes seems that more negativity comes out of it more than anything else. I did go out on Black Friday once, and honestly, the experience kept me from ever even considering doing it ever again. This was a few years back. The big Christmas gift that year was a game called Uno Attack. It was supposed to sell out pretty quickly. My nephew really wanted one. So I decided for the first time ever to brave the Black Friday crowd and see about getting one. I waited outside the store in line for it to open. The entire time, I kept wondering why people were so fanatical about this. It was cold, and although I was reasonably bundled up, it didn't help that I had to spend so much time not moving. In addition, people were in terrible spirits, which seems to take the spirit away from the event itself. Some people would try to cut in line, which only made people already in line crabbier than they were. When the store was getting closer to opening, I noticed that there was someone from the store headed out and talking to each person in line. When they got to me, I realized that he was handing out tickets, indicating who would be able to buy Uno Attack. He asked me if that was why I was there, and I told him yes. He told me I'm lucky, because I was getting the very last ticket. Of course, this caused some groaning and swearing from people behind me. Although I hated the idea that there would be a lot of children who wouldn't be getting the toy they wanted, I personally was elated. That was until this guy got out of line and walked up to me. He came up immediately after that worker left. He first offered to buy the ticket from me. I told him no, because it wasn't a matter of money, it was me trying to make my nephew happy. He then started telling me that his son really wanted that toy. I countered, letting him know that my nephew also really wanted that toy. When I kept refusing, he started telling me other stories, such as his son was really sick, but I could tell he was just doing his best to make me feel guilty. From further back in the line, a few other people began telling the guy to leave me alone. He got into a shouting match with several of them. Eventually, the guy stomped away, but not before telling me that I'll get that toy. I tried to not think about it. I went in, claimed the Uno game, and did some more shopping. I figured that since I'd spent so much time outside, I should try to get as much done as I could. When I was done in the store, I went back out to my car. I put all the toys in the trunk and then walked over to the bookstore and the strip mall in order to get some other items. When I began walking back to the car a second time, I paused when I noticed the man from earlier was leaning on my car now. I began feeling tense, knowing this guy was going to confront me again. He was much bigger than I, but I decided I couldn't let him intimidate me. As I got closer to my car, he noticed and smiled. He reached into his pocket, and I assumed he was reaching for his wallet, but it only took a moment before I saw that it was a pocket knife. And he flipped it open. I immediately stopped. I couldn't imagine this guy would be stupid enough to try and threaten or stab me in a busy parking lot, but I also didn't want to test that theory. I quickly turned around and ran back into the store that I bought that Uno game in. I let the store security know what happened, and they quickly gave me an escort out to my car. The man was gone, but I was still shaken. I was more shaken when I noticed the knife marks on the lock for my trunk, and now my trunk was also dented. There were also deep scratches in my driver's side window. For obvious reasons, I never went out Black Friday shopping again.
When I was a kid, I witnessed a neighbor murder his wife on Christmas Eve. I was still at that age where I actually believed in Santa, so when my mom and dad put me to bed, I stayed up and stared out the window, hoping to catch a glimpse of him landing on the rooftops in our neighborhood. It didn't take long before I realized that I could see into my neighbor's bedroom. It was dark, and all I could see was the shape of a sleeping person covered in a duvet, lit up by the light of a nearby TV. Not exactly Skinamax, I'm sure you'll agree, so I didn't feel too guilty about it, and I kept on looking out for Santa's magic sleigh. Suddenly, there was movement in the bedroom across the way, and I looked in time to see my neighbor walking in on his sleeping wife. I tried to pry my attention away from the bedroom as he moved towards the bed, but then it's quickly drawn back when I see fast, violent movements in the light of the TV. In the low light, it just looked like my neighbor was hitting his wife. And I know that's bad enough, but all I could see were these downward, moving blows and nothing else. So as distressed as I was, all I told my mom and dad when I ran downstairs was like, "I think the neighbor's beating up the neighbor mom." My dad just bolts upstairs, figuring I'd seen something from my bedroom window. He went up to check it out, but by that time, someone had drawn the curtains. My dad asked me if I hadn't just had a bad dream, but I swore to him that I'd been awake and on the lookout for Santa. I then repeated everything I'd seen in exact detail, and by that time, Mom was listening too. When I finished, Dad and Mom gave each other a look. You know, one of those Mom and Dad concerned looks that's like an entire conversation within a silent word spoken. Then, my dad kneels down and asks me something. "Buddy, are you sure that's what you saw? Because we could get in a lot of trouble if that's not true." But again, I'm not totally insistent that I saw what I saw. And I didn't find out what happened immediately after that until quite a while later. But as I was actually drifting off to sleep, Mom and Dad were downstairs having a very tense but quiet conversation. Dad, to his eternal shame, was insisting that I couldn't be sure, that the room had been dark, and that I might have even seen them possibly doing something that I shouldn't have, and just not understood what I was seeing. Mom, on the other hand, was steadfast in her better safe than sorry attitude, and told my dad that if he didn't call the cops, she'd take me to my aunt's place because she wouldn't be celebrating Christmas next to a wife-beating neighbor. And that was that. My dad called the cops. He said he was praying it was some kind of mistake, but given how he could just give an anonymous tip, he figured, why not? My parents then watched from their own bedroom window, which had a view of the neighbor's driveway, as the cops pulled up outside and knocked on their door. They said it was this nail-biting moment, hoping they'd hear the sound of the neighbor's wife answering the door before being all, "Oh, good evening, officers. What seems to be the problem?" That way, they could just carry on drinking eggnog and watching Jesus Christ Superstar or whatever they had on down there. But instead of that, they watched the cops knock, then knock again, all before they apparently turned on their flashlights and began circling the home. What woke me up was hearing, "Sir, come out with your hands up," and all this other cop speak when the police finally blocked off the guy's house for the eventual standoff that would unfold. Our neighbor had a gun and he was threatening to shoot at police officers if they attempted to enter his home. The next thing I remember, my mom is rushing into my room and telling me to get dressed. The cops had knocked at our house and told us that they were evacuating the area, just as a precaution in case a shootout had commenced. Our house had that old stucco style of wall, which is apparently pretty safe, but even so, the cops weren't taking any chances. Considering that we lived in Texas at the time, the guy could have had anything in there. My parents say that when they were driving out of the area, the whole street lit up by blue and red flashing lights. They had no idea what kind of scene that they were going to come back to. This wasn't all that long after the whole Waco thing either. Well, a few years after, but fear of some repeat shootout type deal weighed on everyone's mind as news of the standoff got around town. And it ended pretty anticlimactically. The guy actually took his own life as the police were finally busting into his house. But upstairs they found the dead body of his wife, still lying in her bed, exactly where I'd seen her, stabbed more than 30 times. I hadn't been watching the guy hitting his wife. I'd been watching him stab her over and over again, and all I'd done for a couple of the seconds there was just watch. Once all the info was out there, Mom and Dad tried as best they could to shield me from it, because they correctly figured that once I put two and two together and worked out what I'd seen, I'd be extremely messed up by it. And yeah, I really was. Seeing it screwed me up for a long time afterward, and I didn't grow up out of the general anxiety disorder until my early 20s. I just figured that if our neighbor could do something so terrible to someone he seemed to love, then anyone could do it. People I'd known for years, people I was otherwise warm to, they could be capable of the obscenest acts of random evil. Just because they looked normal, just because they smiled when they saw you in the driveway in the mornings, didn't mean they were a monster, hiding in plain sight.